And this hour, of course, we'll take your phone calls with Andrew Collins as we talk about his work, Atlantis in the Caribbean. And we'll come back and talk about the Edgar Cayce connection and your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Andrew Collins with us. Andrew, Edgar Cayce, the great American prophet, talked about the Hall of Records, Atlantis, Bimini, and its connection with this entire region. And several years ago, you had an opportunity to speak to the organization as well. What exactly did Cayce say? What did he mean?
Well, Edgar Cayce would fall into a trance when he would give readings to those that needed medical help. And aside prescribing whatever medicines were needed for them to recover, he would also give them information about their past lives. And often this past lives included information about Atlantis and the fact that these people had shared a life, you know, with other friends and family in Atlantis. And with this, of course, came various information about what Atlantis looked like and about its people and its civilization and its cities and things like this. And this was an incredible, you know, beautiful, very romantic vision of Atlantis. And it's one which, in many ways, we've not been able to verify as far as archaeology is concerned. As you mentioned earlier, you know, they talked about everything from flying machines to lasers and crystal technology and being able to, you know, to change what we'd call today the, you know, DNA and create mutations in humans and all sorts of very futuristic, high-tech sort of stuff going on. Now, we obviously cannot say whether this is real. We've not found, you know, ruins that have got signs on that tell us that we've reached Atlantis. So, you know, we really don't know whether that's real. But what is real is the fact that a number of things that Ed Cayce said did come true. I mean, for instance, he suggested that Atlantis existed in the Atlantic and that the final portion of it was in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean. And that he pinpointed Bimini in the northern side and said, look there. He said that in 1968 or 1969, I mean, he was talking now in the 1930s or 40s, he said, you know, you will find the first evidence of Atlantis rising again. And sure enough, in 1968, the discovery of the Bimini Road took place. This was done by a gentleman called J. Manson Valentine with a colleague of his. They were in the area and they heard about this feature, which obviously local fishermen knew about. And they were taken out to it and were absolutely amazed by what they found. So the prediction that was given by Edgar Cayce was exactly correct. He also said that to look basically for the mother lode of Atlantis, look further south in the area of what we know today as Cuba. And of course, that's the very area that we're focusing on with this book. But beyond that is the fact that off of the west coast of Cuba, in the year 2000, a Canadian company who were looking for wrecks of old Spanish galleons detected at an incredibly deep depth in the ocean what appeared to be evidence of a massive lost city. And this was off the west coast of Cuba. They were able to map what they considered to be roads, structures, possibly even pyramids, and many other features. And this story became a media sensation at the time. And I actually got involved in it, and the whole story is in Atlantis in the Caribbean of how the whole thing played out. And they discovered something down there. I mean, the problem is that because it was so deep, they needed absolute evidence to try and get funding, which they were doing from Nat Geo, you know, National Geographic magazine, and they just could not get the evidence they needed. They got some very poor video of huge blocks that were down there. And that was about as far as it went. And Nat Geo lost interest. Other parties involved lost interest. And the company concerned went back to salving, you know, Spanish galleons, and that was the end of that. So potentially we could have the city of Atlantis off the west coast of Cuba just waiting to be discovered. So, you know, that's very exciting as well. But whether this will confirm exactly what Edgar Cayce says remains to be seen.
And, of course, he talked about the Hall of Records being in three locations, the base of the Sphinx, somewhere, of course, in the Central America, and also in the Bimini area as well. What do you think could be in those Hall of Records, Andrew?
Well, I think that, I mean, obviously my main interest is focused on the Hall of Records in Egypt, on the Giza Plateau, which was one of the inspirations, of course, for our discovery of the lost cave system beneath Giza in 2008. And although we didn't find, you know, any kind of Atlantean library, you know, full of old stone tablets, we did once again verify that Edgar Cayce had got it right, that there were hidden chambers to be found beneath the plateau at Giza. So if you then switch that to the area of Bimini, which is where he said one of the other chambers will be found, I think that we're probably looking for caves, you know, caves that have got petroglyphs, caves that may have artifacts in them that date back maybe 11 to 12,000 years. And I think that there's probably something similar in the jungles of Central America, probably in the area of Piedras Negras temple complex, in the deep down on the, I think it's on the Usmacenta River, which again my colleagues Greg and Laura Little have investigated. I think you know all three of them relate to cave structures. All three of them were probably seen as almost like the points of first creation, and they may well have artifacts that relate to each other and date back to 10 to 12,000 years. I don't think that we're looking for a library with a lot of stone tablets in them. I think that that is too much of a romantic notion, I believe.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the phones now for you. Kay is in Utah Valley, Utah, to get us started. Hi, Kay. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi. Two quick comments.
Sure.
I would like Mr. Collins to comment about. First of all, some authors claim that Plato gave the time that Atlantis disappeared in lunar years, not solar years. That's my first question. And then my second question is about where the asteroid hit. There's an article online called "Did an Asteroid Destroy Atlantis?" by a Mr. Leonard. And he says that there's a huge impact area off the Atlantic Ocean off the Carolina coast. And when I looked up Carolina Bay, there's a series of elliptical kind of lakes that look like asteroid strikes. And they go in a southeast direction, you know, towards the area of the crater offshore. Do you know anything about that, or have you included that in your book?
You're going to love Atlantis in the Caribbean, because all three of those questions are all answered in the book. I mean, going with them in order, the whole idea that Plato may have misinterpreted the years that he said for the destruction of Atlantis, remember he gave the date of approximately 9,600 BC, that various academics have said, well, he must have got it wrong. So, you know, maybe instead of solar years, he was talking about lunar months. I mean, he doesn't say that at all. So what that does is it allows the dates to come down to sometime in the Bronze Age, around 1500 BC. And providing that you keep Plato's account inside the Pillars of Hercules, inside the Mediterranean, which, of course, is not what he says, then you can find that the destruction of the island of Santorini by a massive volcanic eruption around 1500 BC took place. And this is your Santorini theory of Atlantis. And of course, there's no question that this event would have devastated large parts of the Mediterranean at this time. It almost certainly destroyed the Minoan culture of Crete at this time. And we know that there were tsunamis, wildfires, and other catastrophic events taking place in places like Lebanon, in Israel, you know, on the coast there. So, you know, this is something that would have still been in the memory of people at the time when Plato wrote his account in 350 BC. But I don't believe it's got anything to do with Atlantis itself. I mean, Plato was very specific about where he placed Atlantis and the time frame. And he uses solar years again in another book, one of his other dialogues, you know, and it's quite clear he's talking about, you know, 10,000 years ago and whatever. So that's that. As far as the catastrophe, yes, there is evidence of impact craters off of the east coast of the United States. And these have been looked at. It's debatable whether they are impact, but I think that there is a possibility that they are. And you talked about the Carolina Bays. There are literally hundreds and thousands of so-called Carolina Bays. Now, these are orientated northwest to southeast, elliptical, you know, craters, essentially. Some just, let's say, you know, a few yards long, others a quarter of a mile long or possibly even larger in the area of the Carolinas, North and South Carolina, but also they're found as far north as New York State and as far south as Florida. And I write about these extensively in Atlantis of the Caribbean, giving all of the evidence that suggests that they are the result of an impact event and were caused by fragments of a comet. And this work was also taken up by a Berkeley laboratory scientist by the name of Dr. Richard Firestone. And he went into this in great detail in a book called The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, which came out a few years ago. And he also says that these were impact craters, the Carolina Bays, that date to around 10,800 BC. And I concur completely with him. I've been in touch with him about this. So, as I said, all of this information is there in Atlantis of the Caribbean, and all of it has relevance to Plato's Atlantis story.
It's exciting work, though, Andrew, isn't it?
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, it's like a detective story that's gradually coming together, but it's taken 200 years to do this. And the reason why people have not pinned this down correctly in the past is because we're only just discovering things. I mean, it's only in the past 5 years that we have this absolute evidence of this comet impact, you know, and the impact that it had upon the world at this time. And it wasn't just something that took place in a single day. There were terrible events going on for several hundred years, you know, and as I said, they went all the way down to around 9,600 BC, the very date that Plato gives us. So I think that he was very clever to actually use that date. And I don't think there is any doubt at all that he meant that day. He didn't mean lunar months. He didn't mean solar months, or he didn't misinterpret any information. He got it right.
Let's go to John in Miami, Florida. John, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm acquainted with Manson Valentine. When I was about 10 or 12 years old, I took a course in geology from him at the Museum of Science in Miami.
Aha.
And I remember him telling a story about finding a pyramid and there being some crystal inside, and he swam inside the pyramid and retrieved that. So that's one thing that really stands out in my mind over all of those years. Have you found a pyramid by any chance?
I know the story, and I'm afraid to say that that the story is probably a hoax, and it wasn't Manson Valentine himself that claimed to have found it. It was another gentleman. His name escapes me at the moment. But Ray Brown, that was it. And he went around claiming this for many years, and he would show a crystal ball, and he would take it to lectures. He only died recently. But there's a lot of investigation being done into this story and the accounts that he gave to his close friends. And he did admit to certain people that the story had been made up. So there is no pyramid, certainly not the one that he was talking about. I mean, he said that he dove off of Bimini and discovered this. I'm afraid to say that on this occasion, I think this one is not going to work. And that, you know, there is some great evidence of underwater structures and ruins in this region, but unfortunately that story isn't a good one.
Andrew, I remember a Hollywood movie that had Atlantis with a massive size crystal that they used perhaps as a weapon or something, so that when the island sank, that is what's causing the strange anomalies at the Bermuda Triangle. Have you heard anything like that?
Yes, I have. I mean, I think that these ideas, that they're not from Plato, they come from Edgar Cayce. He believes that they used crystal technology in Atlantis, and they had this this death device known as the Firestone, which they could use and direct to destroy things and kill people and whatever. And this is a fascinating thing. And what's interesting is that a lot of what he said about these crystals and their use of shining light through them actually went on to influence our discovery of the use of masers and lasers.
That's right. That's true.
And, you know, there is even a direct link. I mean, some of the what's so interesting is that after the Second World War, various German scientists that were working on Nazi projects obviously were shipped to America to work, you know, in the laboratories there. And a few years ago, I looked into a case where two of these German scientists were actually working with members of the Edgar Cayce Foundation to investigate exactly what Edgar Cayce had said about lasers, and that, you know, this definitely did influence some of those early discoveries. And this was in the 1940s.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And I've been able to verify this from you know, the people that were working in this particular laboratory, which I think was Sandia, if I remember rightly. I mean, obviously, we know about Werner von Braun, you know, and various other these scientists that came over and helped in the rocket, science and, you know, the race into space and whatever. But there were a number of others that did work as well. So that's an interesting, you know, little strange side.
All right. We're going to come back, Andrew, and take some final phone calls with you as we talk about Atlantis in the Caribbean. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final segment with Andrew Collins, his book, the latest one, Atlantis in the Caribbean. And, of course, we'll get your final calls as well. So how quickly, Andrew, did this calamity occur for the poor people who were on the island of Atlantis? I mean, was it quick? Did they have any warning at all?
Well, let's imagine this. I mean, if you can imagine, one day they got up and they had been previously seeing for a matter of months a comet going through the sky. And then one day, suddenly, they see all of these fireballs
coming
out of nowhere, whizzing through the air, exploding before they even hit the ground, creating these wildfires, suddenly blocking out the sun's light.
Ugh.
And then these massive super tsunamis coming up and sweeping their way across every low-lying area, killing everything and destroying everything in its path. And then even when those waters went away, suddenly the temperature changes, everything changes, the wildfires are continuing. It would have been a terrible time to exist, and we can understand why the memory of Atlantis was so efficiently wiped out at this time.
Oh, the tragedy, the calamity, the horror those poor people went through.
Absolutely.
It was like Pompeii. Worse.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a very good example. And as I said, we shouldn't forget that at that time, 75% of the North American population were killed. And let's just hope that something like this never happens again.
Why isn't there a massive government effort with submarines and everything else searching for Atlantis?
I think it's because in the academic world, Atlantis is referred to as the dreaded I word. It's almost like they can't bring themselves to use that term. And I think one of the reasons for this is that it should always be remembered that Plato's dialogues, although they contained a lot of science and facts and information of the day, you know, including information like the fact that the Earth was probably round and probably was going around the sun as opposed to, you know, a flat Earth with the sun going around it, was obviously believed by many ancient peoples. It still needs to be remembered that his dialogues were fictional. They were set with various historical personages coming together around a table and discussing the matters of the day. And that's how he would convey the information. So, you know, he could make up what he liked. He could include what he liked. He could pad stuff out. He could elaborate where he needed to. And I think it's because of that that the academic world are very reluctant to see Atlantis as a real account of something that went on in the distant past.
All right, let's go to final calls now. We'll go to Shira in Sacramento, California. Shira, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi, Andrew. I have been wanting to talk to you for years. I know you are promoting another book, but I just have to mention From Ashes of Angels, A Forbidden Legacy of a Fallen Race. Absolutely the best researched book that I've found to date on Watchers and Nephilim lore. I am currently doing my own cross-cultural comparison accounts and trying to put a book together. I was an ancient Near East major, and you will definitely be in my footnotes if I get a book out.
Well, no, I appreciate that, and I really do respect.
I've bought so many of these books. I've given them out. My friend Burton, the singer of a band called Fear Factory, he had a band called Ascension to the Watchers and wanted research, was how I kind of got onto it. And I bought your book and gave to him. I also gave a book to the Dark Lord of Australian Rock, Nick Cave. We were having a conversation about it,
really?
And I gave him a copy of your book.
So there you go.
That's good news.
You're everywhere. Okay. Shira, thanks for the call. You got your own promotional person there, Andrew.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I planted them just before the show started.
Linda's in Ontario, Canada now with us. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. Oh, God, this is so fascinating, Atlantis. You could talk forever.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I wanted to know is that the Indians, like the people that escaped from Atlantis that we heard, is it the lost tribe of Israel? I think it was Lost Tribe of Israel, or the people that left Atlantis, were they the Indian, they came to America, or that part, is that true?
Yeah. I mean, firstly, they weren't the Lost Tribe of Israel, so that's something that happened much, much later in time. However, there are Native American tribes, particularly the Yuchi, that's a Y-U-C-H-A tribe, that actually recall that they lived in the area of the Bahamas and that they were forced to leave at the time of a great cataclysm where fires occurred in the sky. There was, you know, a period of darkness and really bad things going on, and that their ancestors were forced to leave the Bahamas at that time and come to North America, where they obviously settled. And this is also matched in Central America and also in South America. For instance, the Aztecs, the Maya, and various other tribes all talk about escaping from an island in the east during a time of great darkness. And it said, for instance, that, I mean, the Maya and the Aztecs both talk about coming from this cave of emergence known as Chicumoztoc, the seven caves. It says that the ancestors of the seven tribes came from there, and they formed, you know, seven different cultures, and you know that this is the memory. And I think I found that cave on the island of Youth off the west coast of Cuba. There's a lot of evidence for that. Cuba was known to them as Talapan, which means the old red land. And what's so interesting is that the Great Plain of Cuba is absolutely red earth, totally red earth. I mean, I've never seen earth so red as that. So it's a memory, I think, of, you know, the fertility and the irrigation and the, you know, the redness, the sheer redness of the ground at Cuba.
Howard's in Vancouver, Washington, and now you're on Coast to Coast, Howard.
Hello, George and Andrew.
Hi there.
Hi. This is a fascinating program tonight. I read some time back about these strange stone spears that are scattered around the countryside in Costa Rica. And I wanted to ask Andrew if he had any idea what might have been going on there.
Yes, yeah. I was looking at one of them outside of the Harvard Museum, is it Peabody Museum in Boston recently? There's one actually just outside of the museum there. And these are literally hundreds of huge, perfectly made stone spheres in hard rock. I think some of them are granite. And they've been found all over the island. I mean, a few others, by the way, have been found in... Sorry, not on the island. Sorry, it's in Costa Rica, so it's actually on the mainland.
Right.
And these are a total mystery. Nobody knows who manufactured them. Nobody knows when they were manufactured, because they're very difficult to date in their own right. Some of them have actually got petroglyphs on them, and some of them have got images that appear to be like boats or ships.
And how did they even get there?
Well, exactly. Absolutely. I mean, certainly the materials were around, but it would have to have been shipped from some distance, I understand. My colleague Hugh Newman has done a lot of work on the Costa Rica stone balls, and nobody knows how old they are. They could be several thousand years old. They could be even older. They certainly belong to a lost civilization that existed in that area, one that has left no memory, not even any kind of folklore or legends about, you know, who they were, what they were doing, you know, why they disappeared. Some of these balls are definitely in lines. Someone suggested that they are navigational, you know, that you would go from one place to another and you would, you know, get to each ball. But that doesn't really make a lot of sense, because in some places you get loads of balls together. So, you know, why would you do that? So it's a complete mystery, and it's one of the enigmas of the world, which we just simply have no answers for at the moment.
Did the Atlanteans have any time to flee, to maybe go to Egypt or other places?
Well, this is, of course, what Atlantis says, sorry, Plato says, and also what Ekkasi says, that some of them even reached inside the Mediterranean and ended up in places like Atlantis. Now, clearly, you know, we haven't got enough information to say whether that's correct or not. What we can say, by looking at mitochondrial DNA, that's the bacterial DNA that's inside everybody, that's passed on from you know, the female line, from mother to daughter, basically, is that there is a particular type of mitochondrial DNA known as haplogroup X. And this has been found both in the Americas and also inside the Mediterranean, on the eastern Mediterranean coast, the areas where the Phoenicians were. A little bit of it in Western Europe. And it has been proposed, I think my colleagues Greg and Laura Little have written about this, that haplogroup X may have originated in Atlantis. And if we see Atlantis in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, then it could well be that peoples were able to reach both the Americas in the West and obviously the African and European continent in the east. And I think that this is a possibility. I think that we have to look at that as a likelihood.
Let's go to Kyle in Spangle, Washington. Happens to be a first-time caller. Go ahead, Kyle.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Great, and thanks for holding so long.
No problem. My question was, what kind of information do you think that we could actually glean from a discovery of Atlantis, and how could that benefit modern society?
Good question. If we indeed find Atlantis, what does that mean for us, Andrew?
Well, I think a lot of it would depend on where we find it. If we do find it in the area of the Bahamas and the Caribbean, then what it will tell us is that there was extremely high culture existing in the Americas as early as 10,000 BC and arguably much earlier. And this will almost level out the field, because at the moment we see the Garden of Eden, the cradle of civilization, in the old world, obviously in the area of what is today the Middle East, you know, the area of Southeast Turkey, Göbekli Tepe. I think that something similar was going on at this time in the Americas, and that it was completely wiped out by this cataclysm. And I think that if this cataclysm had not taken place, we may even be looking at the Garden of Eden somewhere in the Americas. And I think that's a very exciting prospect, because if we could find evidence of this lost civilization there, this would confirm that fact and show that the people in the Americas were just as advanced as those of the Middle East at this time. But of course, because of this terrible comet impact, this cataclysm, all of that was stopped.
Will we find ancient technology if we find Atlantis?
That's a difficult one. I honestly don't know. I mean, when we say technology, what exactly do we mean? Do we mean an advanced knowledge of things like the stars, of geometry, of sound engineering, and stuff like that? I think, yes.
Optics and things like that.
But I think that a lot of the more romantic ideas that were put forward by Casey, I think that they're more a matter of belief. I mean, I'm a great supporter of Edgar Cayce. Obviously, I talk at the Edgar Cayce Foundation conferences often. I'm going back there next year. And, you know, and I have a lot of time for what he said. But I think that it's going to be very difficult for him, for that material ever to be confirmed. So, in other words, I think it has to become a case of personal belief. In other words, what Edgar Cayce talks about is an Atlantis of the heart. I think that's what it is, as opposed to an Atlantis of archaeology.
If we did not have Plato's accounts, would we know about Atlantis?
No. We would certainly know about inhabited islands in the Western Atlantic, but they were called the Hesperides. There are accounts of them, there are accounts of their navigable rivers, what was going on there, their climate. And all of these are detailed in the Atlantis and the Caribbean book. And of course, if people really want information about all of this, my website, andrewcollins.com, there are literally dozens of articles on there about Atlantis. There's a complete introduction to the new book and Atlantis and all of the different candidates of where it is and why. Some work and some don't. And also, I'll probably be talking about this subject next year at the contact in the desert.
I will be there. So let's.
You should be there as well. I shall see you there. That's in May 2017. That's going to be an incredible event. And if anybody's listening to this that wants to come along and talk to me, please do at that time.
That'll be exciting work, Andrew. And, of course, this particular book, Atlantis and the Caribbean, is available to all kinds of folks through what, Amazon.com? How about bookstores,
here? Yeah. I mean, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Come on to andrewcollins.com. All the links are there as well.
Andrew, take care of yourself. Thank you for being on the program. And, hey, I look forward to your next work and getting you back on the program again.
Absolutely. And I'll see you in May next year.
You got it. Andrew Collins, the name of the book, Atlantis and the Caribbean. On our next Coast to Coast program, as we start your week for you, we're going to talk with some people about How Biology Confirms Our Intuition. That's with Douglas Axe. And then later on, Elizabeth Greenwood joins me talking about The People Who Play Dead. That's right, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. People who are trying to make money or hide by claiming that they're dead. Amazing story. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.